Going to cross over live now to Beirut, where Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, is speaking. Let's listen in.
The martyrs of the resistance with all of its movements and all of its parties, the martyrs of the people, the martyrs of the army and the security services, the martyrs of the civil defense, the media, all martyrs who have gone to God, who have risen up to God during that aggressive war. We also salute all wounded and all those who stood with steadfastness and all those who were displaced and were patient and were confident that they would return, all of the honorable families, the families of the martyrs and of the wounded, and the families who also stood with perseverance, who were displaced and who also took in. We salute and we express our thanks once again to all those who took up responsibility and participated in bringing about victory, from presidents and leaders, those who didn't participate, who on the other hand tried to disrupt the process. Let's put them aside. We don't want to create problems. But to all those who assumed responsibility and participated in bringing about victory, presidents and leaders, factions, intellectuals, all those who expressed solidarity and assisted, from governments and countries and peoples, especially those who spared no efforts in providing all kinds of support despite the difficulties. I mean here the Islamic Republic of Iran and Syria. However, I must also mention those who have the biggest, who played the biggest role in bringing about this great historical achievement, and they are the heroic resistance fighters, those who stood with steadfastness in all positions and who fought with courage and who surprised the enemy and terrorized the enemy and overthrew and toppled all of the plans and tactics of the enemy and transferred the battle to the enemy's field. And they did not show any hesitance. They did not show sorrow. They did not weaken despite the brutality of the aggression and the massacres against their beloved, against their families in the cities and in the villages. And they, the resistance fighters, who in the end they imposed on the enemy to cry out for help, to cry out to the Americans in order to end the war in the last days. And therefore we witnessed the holy historic victory in the July 2006 war. We must also, with great appreciation, mention all leaders of the resistance, especially the martyrs, including the leader of the martyrs, Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi, and the Sheikh of the martyrs, Sheikh Raghib Harab, and also the commander, the leader who played a big role in that war, Haj Imad Mughniyeh, Haj Ridwan, and all those who built and laid the foundations for this resistance day after day, generation after generation. We must also mention the leader who built this heroic resistance in Lebanon, Imam Musa Sadr, and especially whereby we are just days away from the anniversary of the painful anniversary of his kidnappings. Brothers and sisters, a lot was said about the July 2006 war. Speeches were made, and there were also conferences which were held, studies, books were also written, studies were conducted, investigations, lessons were drawn, the enemy, from the enemy, the friend, and from our side as well, in the region and in the world. And this war and the repercussions of the war and the results of this war at all levels, this is all being discussed. It's continued to be discussed, continued to be studied, and also investigated, because very simply it wasn't just any incident, it was a real war. It was a war which had far-reaching repercussions and goals, political, moral, economic and historical goals, which are not just about Lebanon and Palestine but about the region. It had international repercussions. We must recall what the American Secretary of State at that time said, Condoleezza Rice, when she spoke about the July 2006 war and said it was to begin a new Middle East, meaning that there were regional goals and also international goals and international repercussions. All of the factors after the war, during the war, a lot was uncovered. However, after the war ended, from what was written and what was recorded, the media interviews, the investigations, the studies which were conducted, the also memos which were written from presidents and heads of state and generals and foreign ministers, all of this provided this information, these documents, these memoirs, especially what was said by the Israelis and what they explained and what the Americans also said and explained, and what was also said to me by one of the senior American intellectuals. This is nothing a secret. He wrote it in many different articles. It became clear in the aftermath that the July 2006 war was a fundamental part of a chain of events which wanted to achieve a goal in the end. What was required in July 2006, first of all, via this war, they wanted to put an end to the resistance and crush the resistance in Lebanon, not to just to disarm the resistance in Lebanon, not disarming it and keeping its structure or keeping the people or keeping this entity which could arm itself once again. No, what was required, the goal was not to disarm the resistance, it was to crush the resistance, to kill its leaders, to kill its commanders, and to strike at its joints and to strike its mujahideen, to arrest the highest number possible. And if you recall back then, in one of the settlements in the north, one of the Israeli settlements, they were getting ready to arrest 10,000 people. So there was a structural change they wanted to bring about via this war. So this was one part, one episode. When they put an end to the resistance, this is information, this is not analysis. This all became clear after the information which was provided, under the excuse that Syria stood in support of the resistance, provided it with arms, supported it with missiles and some qualitative weapons, then the Israelis would go ahead and strike Syria, which would lead to toppling the government in Syria and bring about an alternative who is a friend or an ally of the US in Syria. Let me remind you, this it all was in 2006, after the occupation of Iraq and the American, big American military presence in the region. Now, the third part of this plot was to strike the Palestinian resistance, especially in the Gaza Strip. Those who mentioned the information, they said that all this should have been implemented in 2006, meaning before the end of 2006, because if I recall, there were congressional midterm elections in America, and George Bush and the neocons wanted to go, according to the American expressions, they wanted to go into the legislative elections with carrying three heads which were spilling with blood. This is what I was told. The head of the resistance in Lebanon, the head of the resistance in Palestine, and the head of the government in Syria. And therefore, before July 2006, those who were following American media would notice that they were very much exaggerating when it comes to Hezbollah and Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, and also the government in Syria, their role in terrorism and their role in other aspects. This was all part of a psychological media moral preparation to prepare, and if these heads are really cut, George Bush can then tell the Americans, I cut off the heads, the three heads of international terrorism, so go ahead and elect me because I am the one who guarantees America's interest. And then the other step, after achieving a majority in Congress, the other step would be to prepare for a war on Iran and to overthrow the government in the Islamic Republic of Iran in 2007. It was supposed to happen in 2007. And so therefore the aim of this plot, I'm not speaking for the sake of history because I want to draw some lessons or focus on it. The aim was two. There were two fundamental goals. The first was American, complete, solid American control on all oil and gas installations, oil and gas in the region. They take control of the region. They strike the resistance movements. They topple the government in Iran. They take control of Iran in the Gulf. They already exist. And so the most important sources of oil and gas, therefore, are in this geographical area. Second, and here is the real strike or targeting of the resistance movements in Syria and Iran, was to put an end to the Palestinian cause and impose a settlement on the Arabs and Palestinians in accordance with the Israeli conditions. All of this plot was to reach this goal. What were the elements of this approach? They were direct American occupation of Iraq. Of course, before it was Afghanistan. Afghanistan now was a reaction to September 11. So first of all, American presence and occupation, direct occupation. Second of all, Israel and the Israeli war. Israel was assigned with achieving the toppling of the Syrian government and putting an end to the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine in order to achieve this goal. And therefore, this trajectory, this plot, who prevented it, who obstructed it? The resistance in Lebanon, the historic Lebanese steadfastness, and all those who I mentioned before, who I saluted before, the victory of the resistance and Lebanon in July 2006 toppled this plot, or at the very least disrupted this plot. Why? Because the battlefield, and this is something which we mentioned on Al-Quds Day and which we renew once again, we're speaking to Gaza, the resistance, and our Palestinian brothers. We are saying this, why? Because the battlefield forced the Israelis to cry out, and when they reached the point whereby they no longer could do anything, they used air power as much as they could. They exhausted their land forces. Also, there was no room left, or the naval power was out of the calculation. The Israelis reached the point whereby they were heading towards a military catastrophe, and therefore they requested from the Americans to put a stop to the war. Everything which was written in the memos, what was told, what we were told by foreign ministers and Arab officials who participated in the discussions in New York at these very same days in 2006, all stress on what we said, the steadfastness of the resistance, the steadfastness of Lebanon, the steadfastness of the resistance in the battlefield, first of all. Number two, the steadfastness of the people and the popular support of the resistance. And number three, the political steadfastness, bearing in mind that we did have a big political problem inside Lebanon, but the political steadfastness did lead to the Americans and the Israelis and the Europeans and the Security Council to make concessions, to back down from the conditions which they had imposed on in week one, two, and three to put an end to the war on Lebanon. What was the result? The result was that resistance in Lebanon remained. It wasn't crushed. Its structure wasn't struck. It wasn't disarmed. And even more, its capabilities even increased in the resistance's structure, its equipment, its popularity, its respect, and its confidence. This all increased. Number two, the war, the Israeli war, didn't reach Syria because they didn't succeed in Lebanon. If they wanted to go into Lebanon, they were going into a catastrophe. So how could they expand to Syria? Number three, the war on the Gaza Strip didn't happen, or it was delayed in 2006, although before the aggression against Lebanon, we did witness brutal or very, very harsh, widespread air bombardment of the Gaza Strip. And even more, the resistance in Iraq increased against the American occupation, and the political steadfastness in Iraq and the resistance in Iraq and the national will of the Iraqis led the American occupiers to leave without preserving for itself any military bases or any immunity for its generals. And the neocons were defeated in the elections, and a new administration came, and therefore the plot was defeated. This doesn't mean that the American goals were were defeated or toppled. No, we must always bear in mind that there are American, permanent American goals in the region. For the sake of achieving these goals, it pursues certain courses or puts together certain plans. If you overthrow one way, the Americans resort to another plot, a third or fourth or fifth plot, until you completely defeat this American Zionist project in the region. There will no longer be any goals, nor a plot, nor any course to achieve the goals. However, as long as this American-Israeli project, and as long as these American goals, which Israel is part of, as long as they exist, they are always looking for a certain course. In accordance with the developments and the factors which exist, and therefore this war failed. I'm saying this, why? First of all, in order to discuss the most important topic tonight, and second, in order to remind of the magnitude of the victory of 2006, so that it cannot be forgotten in light or in the midst of these events. Lebanon, the Lebanese people, the Lebanese resistance, the state, the army, all those who played a real role in this achievement and in this victory, and all those who played a role in bringing about this political, military victory, this human victory, whatever you want to call it. And its aftermath, the repercussions still exist today. And second, to stress, and this is a very important point, we want to stress today, in light of the dangers and the current and future challenges, we want to stress that we are all capable of confronting these challenges and dangers, and capable of toppling any plots, any conspiracy plots against our country, our region, against our peoples, and against our sanctities. Because in July 2006, when the Americans went ahead with this plot, they had all the elements of power. And I would also say that back then, the Americans were at the very top, at the peak of their power. Never did we see a power reach this level, which the Americans had reached after 2001, 2002. The peak of American power, militarily, from the security angle, politically, intelligence-wise, media, the peak of control. This was a situation at that time. Second of all, the regional situation, the circumstances, we didn't have a Soviet Union, we didn't have socialist movements, Arab world, they were all destroyed. And they all crumbled, collapsed in front of the Americans, the international circumstances, regional circumstances. So he who could confront them at that time, not speaking about any specific side, those in Lebanon and in the region, from Lebanon to Palestine to Syria to Iraq to Iran to the rest of the region, all in accordance with their capabilities. So those who were able to topple such a plot back then are of course capable of toppling another plot. This is why I mentioned it, for the sake of reminding you. Today what is taking place in the Gaza Strip, and let me go to the current reality. What is taking place in the Gaza Strip today, the war and the Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip, is part of a new course. We said that the other course or the other plot failed. So now the region witnessed developments and events. We might disagree in our evaluation. We might disagree in how we read it. We might disagree when it comes to the reasons behind these developments. However, the whole Arab world has entered into a new situation. Now, in light of this new situation, the Americans put together a new plot or another project in order to achieve their goals. They are the same goals: to take control of the region or of the sources of oil in the region, and also for Israel to have the upper hand to eliminate the Palestinian cause, impose conditions on the Arabs and the Palestinians in accordance with Israeli conditions. The same goals, they don't change. The tactics change. The course changes. What is taking place in Gaza today is part of this new course, which had begun after the war on Gaza. Today, Gaza is a chain, one part of this chain, or a chain in this new course. And there are two elements, not one element here. just as the situation was in the previous decade. In the previous decade, as I said, we had two elements. The first was American occupation, direct American military action, which led to the occupation of Iraq, which led to control of the Gulf via this occupation. And second, Israel and the Israeli army and the Israeli war. Today, the Americans, after they left Iraq and their trouble in Afghanistan, they are very cautious in coming back militarily to the region, or at the very least coming back with land forces. So then when they speak about American Air Force or participation from the air, Obama and the Minister of Defense or the Secretary of Defense, they all say we don't want to send ground forces. And this reflects something. Anyway, today there are two elements or two fundamental factors which are being used in this new approach. Very frankly, and I will speak very clearly, I will name things very frankly, and I will speak about everything, as I said, I will name everything very clearly. And allow me, for those who are listening, let us open our hearts, let us open our minds, because we all in Lebanon and in the region, we are in an existential danger today. I'm not speaking here about who is better and who can get more. I'm speaking about existence. Existence. So there is a new approach. I will go back to the new approach. This new approach is more dangerous than the previous one because it is not an approach which aims to topple governments and bring about other authorities to replace them. When you say you bring about another replacement, that means the country remains, the entity remains, the state remains, the borders remain, the social fabric remains. It might be harm, but it remains. The army remains. But you're taking away one authority and replacing it with another. In this new approach, it's not an approach of toppling governments and bring about alternative authorities. It is an approach which we spoke about more than once, an approach of destruction, destroying countries and armies and people and entities. And what is happening bears witness to what I'm saying. This new approach is to fragment and to destroy and to crush everything. This is the current approach being pursued by the Americans and those who are with them in the region, along with Israel. The aim is to draw a new map of the region. But what kind of map? After the First World War, the Second World War, now what will this new map be based on? Based on fragmented remains, not remains of people only, the remains of countries, the remains of peoples, of societies. Debris, not to have walls left, no. Also to destroy the people's minds as a result of the events or of the plans in the region. Even people get confused. Where will we go? What alternatives, what options do we have? And also to leave behind hearts which are terrified. There is a very, very touching scene. When we saw a helicopter in Sinjar, Iraqi or American, I don't remember. I think it was an Iraqi helicopter because it was was downed. When it was taking aboard women and children from the land, from the ground. Look at the faces and the eyes of the women and children, and remember your women, your wives and your children, to realize what this new map will be based on. It will be based on ripped apart bodies, debris, people who no longer know how to think, terrorized hearts. The aim is for all of us in the region to enter into a catastrophe, and for the sake of getting rid of this catastrophe, we would accept anything, any dictations. The most important thing, get us out of this catastrophe, whatever you want. That is the aim. A social catastrophe, security, political, economic, ideological, sympathetic catastrophe, and even worse, the enemy, the main enemy, would become the savior in the end. This is what, where they're dragging our region towards. Now, who are the main elements in this new approach? The Israelis, and this is what I said about Gaza, what is taking place in Gaza, the destruction. The realistic aim, as our Palestinian brothers said, as we heard, is to strike the resistance and disarm it and end the structure of resistance and make people desperate and against everything which is called resistance for Gaza to give up, nothing to remain, just debris and remain ruins. And the other element, which is no less dangerous, is the so-called Takfiri wave, which today has become, or its most clearest images is expressed in the form of Daesh or ISIL. It is the biggest reflection of this Takfiri wave. These are the elements of the new approach. Now, I'll go back to ISIL, but let me begin by posing a question. Can we defeat this new approach? Can we defeat it? Yes. Yes, I tell the Lebanese and the Syrians and the Iraqis and the Palestinians and all peoples of the region, yes, we can defeat this new approach, just as we defeated the previous plan. However, this doesn't come by making wishes. This comes by acting. Dua helps action. It requires conditions, it requires elements, it requires efforts which should be pursued. There are two main themes which I want to focus on to say that yes, we can reach the stage whereby we can defeat this new approach. The first is that we realize, we must realize, and we must understand and believe, first of all, that there is a real threat. There is an existential threat against us all. We must all take attention. Is there such a danger? Yes or no? Second, is this a genuine danger or is it a joke? Is it some kind of silly joke? What is it? The repercussions of this danger, its capabilities, the capabilities of this danger, we must realize it, understand it, believe it, first of all. Not say that no, there's nothing. Of course, we must not exaggerate, neither should we belittle. Some say that no, there's nothing, there's no danger. This is a silly joke. That's a simple event. No, some people say that. Now, that's wrong. Why? Because at some point, you, for example, in Lebanon, you might confront this danger face to face. You haven't prepared yourself, you don't have a strategy, you don't have strong factors of strength, you don't have a plan, and thereby you would express regret when it's too late, and you would have lost time. That's wrong. And those who say there is nothing, no problem, they have nothing to do with reality. All with what that we're witnessing around us, does that mean there's nothing? Is it nothing? Does it show there's no danger? Second of all, to exaggerate things, which leads to a situation of fear and desperation and frustration and a spirit of defeat, and people would then say, how can we pack our bags and leave? And some people go and stamp their passports, and others say, where should we hide? Because there is a danger coming and we cannot confront it, just like what happened in the region during the Mongolian invasion. That approach isn't true. We can't say that there's nothing and it's a joke, but we can also not say that we can't confront this danger and be desperate and frustrated. No, both are wrong. The correct way is to realize this danger, its magnitude, its capabilities, to believe that there is such a danger, that's number one. And the second is to look for the means with which to confront this threat in order to topple it and end it and defeat it. Real, genuine tools, serious tools, not to go to illusions, not to resort to meaningless options, not to resort to options which were used before and failed and didn't lead anywhere. Let's resort to realistic options from the history of our region, of our peoples, of our ummah, the history of humanity. Let's draw lessons from all of the international and regional factors and say, yes, we do have these means, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Let's put together a plan and say these are the elements of the plan, and let's prepare in order to confront this threat. In such a way, yes, we can defeat it. If we look at past experience, if we look at July 2006, this current Gaza war, the previous Gaza war, the experiences of the resistance, what took place in the region, the Palestinians and the Lebanese and the peoples of the region and the whole Arab world, the whole Muslim world, for tens of years, since before 1948 until today, we all witnessed a very, very bitter, sorrowful experience. Sometimes it was a disappointing experience. It was very harsh for the people and for the governments and for the generations. And this is what we inherited, which is the experience of Israel, the Zionist project, the Zionist expansion, etc. Now, just to shed more light on this idea, at the beginning of the 20th century, when they began to bring the Zionists, family by family, farmers and others and businessmen, bring them to Palestine, how many were they? How many were there? How many Jewish in Palestine? If you look to any Palestinian and Arab and ask and said the Jews want to put together a state via the Zionist project, want to put together a state in Palestine, they would have said, you're joking. They would have answered and saying, you're joking. When they began to bring them, there was no appreciation of the danger. Some people didn't even view that there was a danger. Some people took it too lightly. Some people looked at it from a humanitarian perspective, said that these are people who were displaced and they were subject to harshness in World War II. So if some families come and stay here or there, what's the problem? We have big land in Palestine. The Palestinians don't occupy all Palestinian geography, don't live in all Palestinian lands. And from the beginning, when these families came, they were distributed in different settlements, and there was a certain military security job for them. Nothing was a coincidence, but the people, the intellectuals, the governments, many people, I won't say everyone, there were some people who understood what was taking place. There were some who were vigilant, some who were aware, some who had expectations before, anticipated. Some people rang the alarm bell, but no, the big majority didn't realize it. And when we reached 1948, they said, okay, they want to take 1948 and put together a country. Okay, Palestine is a big state. Okay. They didn't say that this is a big danger and Israel wants to expand and has its eyes set on Al-Quds. Even in 1967, some Arabs started to make excuses for Israel. They said Israel doesn't have any expansionist goals. No, Israel didn't want to annex the West Bank, nor did it have its eyes set on Eastern Al-Quds. It doesn't want to take control of the Golan Heights or Lebanon or Jordan. What Israel did in 1967 was a preemptive war because it had information that the Arab countries and the Arab armies, and especially the Egyptian and Syrian armies, were preparing for a decisive war against the Israelis, in addition to the Palestinian factions back then. So the poor Israelis, they waged a preemptive war, but they don't want to expand. Wasn't this said in the Arab world back then? Now, then the threat grew until we reached the stage whereby Israel became a state with one of the biggest militaries in the world, one of the strongest countries in the world. It makes threats, it displaces people, it kills people, it commits massacres, and then it goes to the table of negotiations to impose its conditions. This result, how did we reach this scenario? We reached it from the mistakes in the beginning. From the beginning, there was a discussion. Those Zionists who came from all over the world, do they pose a threat or not? If they do, what is the magnitude of this threat? What are their capabilities? What are their strengths? What are they? This is first. Now, when we go to, and when it comes to the implementation of the second part, there was a reliance on the wrong options, on the wrong means. Some people relied on the international community, international institutions, on the Arab ties with the allies. Some believed the English, the British, some believed the French, and some believed the Americans. Some relied on international intervention. Then they relied on the Arab League, waiting for the Arab unified Arab strategy. This took place in Lebanon, Palestine, and in all the confrontations with the Zionist project, the OIC, Organization of Labour Corporation, the Arab and Islamic Unity. And we waited. 10 years passed, and another 10 years came, and then they passed, and 70 years have passed, actually, even more. If we begin from the beginning of the last century. So we went to negotiations, let's cry out for help from the world, from international conscience, from human rights, the Geneva Accord. What is this? This didn't lead us anywhere. Experience, past experience, proves that we don't make any progress. Everything which the Lebanese and Palestinian, the people of the region, were subject to, proves that such options don't lead us anywhere. Whoever thinks otherwise, let him explain, let him argue, prove it. What is clear is that from the beginning, resorting to armed struggle, liberation wars, to what was called military option, this was clear. There were terrorist gangs which were supported by some foreign countries who occupied the Palestinian territories on the 1948 territories and displaced the Palestinians and transformed the Palestinians into refugees inside their land and also beyond Palestine. And the goal was for, or what should have happened was that the Ummah should rise up, armies should be prepared, the resistance factions should prepare in order to achieve the goal and force the invaders to leave. This was the right road. There was no other road. But this plan was pursued partially only. The Palestinian resistance factions from the beginning, they came about before 1948, and after, all this should be remembered as history, and we must learn from it as history. Then we headed to the confrontation in Egypt, the three-way war, or the three-party war, and also 1967, the war which took place, and the 1973 war, when we saw the Egyptian and Syrian armies who waged a heroic battle, but it reached the result which we all know. Now, the resistance factions in Lebanon and Palestine, when we did have achievements or victories, and when we did have progress, it was because of this option, this kind of option, not because of the other options, futile options, which we kid ourselves with, or we joke our, kid our people with. One of the theories, for example, which continued for tens of years, was that the option is we have a Zionist lobby in America, let's put together an Arab lobby so that we could be on equal footing with the Zionist lobby and pressure the American administration and achieve a solution in the Middle East. What kind of talk is this? It's nothing. It's kidding people. Now, this experience which we witnessed with Israel today, if anyone in Gaza and the people of Gaza and its factions and its people and its will and its resistance, they are relying on all these options. They don't want to surrender to the Israelis, despite all of these sacrifices, martyrs, destruction. The resistance doesn't have any option. Now, today, any Palestinian brother or sister who is sitting in Gaza or anywhere else and recalls all of this modern history, I'm not speaking about 200 or 1,000 years ago, anyone who thinks about this recent history would realize this is the appropriate path and will, of course, enable us to achieve results. And they achieve, this option has achieved results before. Now, implementing these two factors when it comes to a file or an issue which still exists today, which is confronting the Zionist project. Let's go to the second main theme. Here I want to say a few words. Let me tell my beloved brothers, my sisters, all Lebanese, the people in the region, all those who are listening. Based upon everything which I have said, irrespective of what took place over the past 3 years, irrespective of the disagreements and the differences in evaluation and the reasons and who was responsible and you made a mistake, no we did, we're right, no you're right. Irrespective, let's set all this aside. Now, this doesn't benefit. It's useless now to speak about this. Why? Because we have a real danger. We have a real danger. A real danger to our entities, to our sanctities, to your foreign existence, to your mosques, to your churches, to your women, your children. Therefore, now is not the time to go ahead and revise. Let's do it later. Now, the whole region and the peoples of the region are facing a big, real danger. Today, what we call ISIL, now when we look, what is this? Let's speak in accordance with the facts. Today, we have an organization which has become a state, it's no longer an organization, which occupies or controls a very wide, large geographical area, part of Syria and part of Iraq. Now, this geographical area is larger than many of the countries in the region and the world when we speak geographically. It controls energy sources, oil and gas. It controls very important rivers and dams. Now, it also possesses a very high amount of weapons and ammunition. It sells oil and there are some who buy this oil and facilitate. And this is something which we must put a question mark on. There are countries who have many problems when it comes to selling oil. How is ISIL selling oil and getting money under the eyes of the international community and the regional countries? Many of the fighters, many of them who are really relied on, are not Syrian fighters or Iraqi fighters, as much as they are fighters who came from beyond, and their travelling was facilitated and their entry across the borders was also facilitated. Here I also put a question mark. This organisation which has such a presence and which also has an ideology and a certain understanding and which also has a certain behaviour. We saw its behaviour in Syria and in Iraq. It began with massacres, not a battle, no. It committed massacres. It killed prisoners, it had taken captive, it killed people who had nothing to do with the battle. It began first of all with the people from the same organization, from the same ideology, from the same base, who are Nusra. It began by fighting and Nusra. Then it spilled the blood of the remainders of its allies, who are normally their allies, the Syrian armed groups. And today, there is fighting taking place in the northern countryside of Aleppo between ISIL and others. In some areas, al-Nusra stepped aside or disassociated itself. We have also fighting in the countryside of Idlib. In Deir ez-Zor, we also had very big confrontations. Then we reach Iraq. In Syria and in Iraq, everyone who disagreed with ISIL was fought and killed and slaughtered by ISIL. Even the practice, they deliberately want to terrorize. If you think you can kill these people, shoot them. No, they slaughter them. And they slaughter them in front of the cameras and download it on YouTube and make it show it also on satellite media. This is part of psychological war, part of spreading fear, a state of terror amongst the people and the armies of the region. The massacres which were committed, and I'd like to tell you, first and foremost against the Sunnis, and you can go back and look at the numbers. Who was killed from the Sunnis? The religious clerics from the Sunnis who don't support the government, who are against the governments, and they were killed. The people who were killed by ISIL, because According to ISIL, the Sunnis, who we know as Sunnis, they're considered as infidels by ISIL, because according to ISIL's ideology, the infidels are these people and those people, and also the Muslim non-believers. And most Sunnis, according to ISIL, are non-believers or infidels, ideologically speaking. Even if they are, they agree with the same ideology, even if they disagree with them politically, they are also slaughtered by ISIL. Isn't this what happened today, this last war, which was waged by ISIL? What are the Kurds? Are they Christians or Shia? Most of the Kurds are Sunnis. This last war, more than 1.5 million were displaced because of ISIL's war in Iraq, and they were Sunnis. Other than Shia and Azidis and Christians, in Iraq, they spared no one. If we speak about religions, Muslims, Christians, and Yazidis, and Shia and Sunni, they spared no one. If we speak ethnically, Arabs, Kurds, Turkmens, also no one was spared. And the same goes for the battle in Syria. Arabs and Kurds, no one is spared. This is ISIL. The sanctities, places of worship, mosques, churches, there is a way of life which they want to impose by weapons and by terrorizing. They want to impose it on all people, not just on Muslims, Muslims and Christians. And this way of life has nothing to do with Islam or Muhammad, son of Abdullah, may peace be upon him. It has nothing to do with the Holy Quran. No, this is something else. Go and ask the religious clerics of all different sects. Now, doesn't this scenario exist? Is this a joke? And then they are declaring their goals. They put together, they show you the map which they want to draw, and they make threats. And what is even more dangerous is that, yes, they do have a base. Let's not hide the facts. They do have base, support base in many Arab countries, not from the Sunnis, no. Their base is those who follow this ideology, who consider anyone else as a kafir or an infidel, who swore the blood of anyone who disagrees, who say that we are coming to slaughter you. And such people don't belong to ever any religion. Nobody who believes in God says we are coming to slaughter you, especially this group. Our Prophet Muhammad stood in Mecca in confronting who? In confronting Abu Sufyan and the others, those who fought him and displaced him and killed his friends and killed his uncle and also ate the liver of his uncle and took over homes and inflicted so much harm, to the extent why the Prophet said, no Prophet was harmed as much as me. And they still were non-believers. Some people still remain non-believers, and they left. But what did the Prophet say to them? He said, leave, you're free to go. He didn't hang them, nor did he slaughter them, nor did he say, I'm coming to slaughter you. When did he say this? This is the slogan of ISIL and this wave. So we have a real scene in front of us. He who denies this lives in another world. He doesn't, such a person who believes, who says this, doesn't deserve to take responsibility. His family, his children, he doesn't even deserve to have responsibility over his family and children. He who doesn't believe that we have such a danger. Now, ISIL was left, regardless of who supports ISIL, this issue that the Syrian intelligence or Iraqi intelligence or Iranian intelligence, some people say even reach the level where they said Hezbollah controls ISIL. This is silly. It doesn't even deserve a comment. But there are some regional countries who sponsor ISIL, who enabled ISIL to reach this stage. The Americans either have some kind of role, according to what Hillary Clinton said. I'm not sure if it's right or not, but what I do know is that the Americans disregarded and facilitated and expanded and opened the doors in order to take advantage of this image, of this trend. Of course, they have penetrated. Of course, we do have American influence. whether they realize or not, they are supporting the American and Israeli goal, ISIL. So we reached this current stage. Here I would like to ask, because this is the last part of my speech, I call on every Lebanese, every Palestinian, every Syrian, every Iraqi, every Gulf citizen to sit with himself. Allah says, sit down. Sit down and think. Let's put aside the anger, the sectarian hatred, the hatred of all different forms. Let's take away the animosities between political factions, the personal hatreds, and let's sit down and think with ourselves. Is this a danger to everyone? Is this a danger to Hezbollah? In Deir ez-Zor, did we have Hezbollah? In Raqqa, do we have Hezbollah? In Mosul, did we have Hezbollah fighting and therefore ISIL came and invaded Mosul? Is this a danger to Shia, only to Shia, to Christians only, to Yazidis only, to the Alawites, to the Ismailis, to the Abadiyis, who are for now still a bit distant, to the Druze? This is a danger to all, and first and foremost to the Sunnis. So what we sincerely hope, let nobody perceive or say that this is a sectarian confrontation. It's not Muslim against Christian. It's not Shia against Sunni. It is another kind of war. It is the ISIL war. And this ideology, takfiri, killing, slaughtering ideology, which kills anyone who's against them. It has nothing to do with Islam, nothing to do with what happened during the era of the Prophet or the map of the region or the religious minorities. This will all be crushed. But this is 1,400 years old. These sects, these minorities, these churches and these mosques and these places of worship, these sanctities, these holy sites which are being destroyed, they are more than 1,400 years old, and they were mostly under the eyes of Sunni governments, according to the terms which I use. But these people have nothing to do with this history or this culture. They are coming to crush everything, to crush and destroy everything. And they are a danger to all. Anyway, first of all, we must realize that such a danger exists. Second, we must come and ask the question, what should we do? We who are all in danger, what should we do? Should we, for example, should we draw lessons from the confrontation with Israel, which still exists now? Should we, for example, resort and rely on the international community and say we can't do anything? Let's talk to the Americans, to the French, to the British. Now Russia is preoccupied with Ukraine. Let's see what can we do. We have no option but for the international community to intervene. What international community to intervene? Where? For the interests of who will it intervene? What happened in Iraq? I'm not calling for American intervention, but a question. When ISIL invaded Mosul and the Nineveh province and a very large part of Salah ad-Din province and also penetrated Diyala and committed massacres and slaughterings, and people went to the desert and all the slaughtering was all seen on television. No international community intervened. Obama's humanitarian feelings weren't shaken, or the Obama administration's feelings weren't shaken. The Christians, the hundreds of thousands, do they care about the Christians in Mosul or in Iraq or in Lebanon? Let me tell the Christians of Lebanon, between brackets, if any one of you still thinks that the Christians in Lebanon mean anything for America and the West, you're mistaken. In light of any danger, you will be told, as France told the Christians of Iraq, come, we welcome you as refugees and you'll be given citizenships. The project which some of your elderly heard from the former French president, this is the real project Will there be a West which supports the Christians? Are you waiting for the Americans and French and British and the international community and the UN and the Security Council after all what happened and is happening? Nobody asked what happened to the Christians or the Sunnis or the Shia or the Yazidis, even the Kurds who were killed in Mosul and on the outskirts of Kirkuk and Zamnar and Sanjar. No questions, all the Turkmans or the Arabs, when they approached Erbil, yes, because Kurdistan means what it means politically, from the security perspective, economically, for the American administration and for the West, then they intervened. Because here, no. Here, ISIL, you're not allowed to go beyond. That's your border. You can slaughter the Sunnis, yes. You can slaughter the Shia, yes. You're allowed to slaughter the Christians and destroy their churches and rape their women, yes. You're allowed to commit genocide against the Yazidis, yes. Okay, Turks, Arabs, Turkmens, no. No difference. But Erbil, it's a different situation. This is Kurdistan. In the map, it has a unique place for the Americans and for the international community. So should we rely on them, we the Iraqis or the Lebanese or the Jordanians or the Palestinians or the Syrians, should we rely on such a West? Who should you wait for? The Arab League to protect you? Should you wait for American consensus, a unified Arab strategy? And let me be here very clear, in any country, when anyone senses that his presence is in danger, his existence is in danger, would he wait for national unity or consensus? Have we seen anything like this in history? So the big question, if we agree that there is a danger, the question is, how do we confront this danger? What do we resort to? What are the means, the capabilities? The Iraqis, the Syrians, the Palestinians, the people of the region, they all have big responsibilities. I want to speak to the Lebanese, and this logic also applies to the other peoples and the other countries, because thank God we have leaders and we have clerics and factions and very excellent parties who do take up their responsibilities. Me and you people in this country, let me speak about Lebanon specifically. Now, we as Lebanese, if we agree that this danger does exist and it is an imminent danger, not a delayed danger, a danger which comes 1 or 2 years later, look at Iraq before Mosul. We had one situation, we had a different situation just after one night. And after one day and night, after one day passes, a lot can change. A lot can change in one night, because ISIL today is a real danger for Syria and Iraq. But when it comes to capabilities, it's a threat to Syria and Iraq. It's also, however, with its strength, it's a threat to Lebanon and the Gulf, and even the Turks must reconsider. It's a threat to all countries. So what can we do as Lebanese? What should we do? What should we resort to? There are even questions which are being asked today, which seriously, I say we as Hezbollah, let us sit down and discuss, and we want to discuss it with the other Lebanese, and the Lebanese, we want them to discuss amongst themselves. I'm not calling for a national dialogue conference, because in such an issue we won't reach anywhere. This requires, as I said, every party in itself, every group, let it sit down, let us sit down, one-to-one, two-to-two, intellectuals. What should we do? We must ask a question, what should we do? There is a serious question which is always raised. It's not about settling scores politically amongst ourselves. A question which is always raised is the solution is for Hezbollah to withdraw from Syria. That point is always raised. Maybe the main reason for Hezbollah's presence, Qalamun and Qusair, the border areas, withdrawing from Qalamun and Qusair. I ask the question, to the Lebanese and to the people of the Bekaa region especially, and all the Lebanese, Muslims and Christians. Seriously, seriously, let's put this, put these arguments aside. Let's put this bickering aside. Hezbollah, if it withdraws from Syria, do you really think that the danger will no longer exist to Lebanon? That ISIL doesn't want to seize Lebanon, and some Lebanese officials here, will they then go to Mosul and sit down with Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and say that this map you put down on TV, please, here we have 10,000, I don't know how many, 52 kilometers because they increased a bit. Please, take this out of your map, because we spoke to Hezbollah and Hezbollah will withdraw from Syria. Is this serious? Withdrawing from Qalamun and Qusair, will it protect Lebanon? Irrespective if it's a reason or not. Well, it's useless now to speak about it. Now, it's a reason or it's not a reason. We won't reach any result here. Anyway, every person has his own logic. Let's now speak about now. The region is in danger, the whole region. Now is not the time for these confrontations or these arguments. Like what happened in July 2006, buildings were destroyed, people were being slaughtered, and some people were saying, whose fault is it? It's your fault. You kidnapped Israeli soldiers. Okay, there's a problem in the country. Later, it'll be clear whose fault it is. Now, national unity or national responsibility requires from us to confront the war. Now, national responsibility requires from us to stand and protect our country, our people, our society, our areas. I would like to ask a serious question. I want you. Discuss with us.
Okay, that was Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, speaking there live in Beirut, speaking about various points. But let's just speak about the Gaza war first. He said the Arab world is in turmoil for many reasons, such as oil and other strategic goals that are being carried out for Israel's sake. He said the Gaza war is a continuation of those strategic plan that is being put in place at this time. He also spoke about ISIL at length, speaking about the fact that it has been supported by many of the regional governments. And so the United States, too, is at the very least implicit in the fact that it even exists and in its crimes. And he said, essentially, the goal through ISIL is to strike fear and to create chaos within the region, within Gaza itself as well, he said. In fact, through the Gaza war in that case. And he said of the case and the plan at this point is then to have the Western governments come in as saviors so that all of these regional governments can say that, look, the West has saved us. And he said, therefore, the Western governments keep saying to the regional governments that you have to ask us for help, though he said that is not the way to go forward. The way to go forward, he said, is to stick with the resistance, is to make sure that the invaders leave our lands, i.e. the lands of the Middle Eastern region. And he, of course, spoke about at length about the Takfiri wave and the fact that it's been destroying a lot of sanctities of people of all walks of life, be they Christians, be they Sunnis, be they Shias, be they Yazidis, or others. And no doubt we will have further analysis on that long speech of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah later on here on Press TV. Thanks very much for watching.
Press News Ali Risk, our correspondent, joins me from Beirut to elaborate more on Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's speech. Ali, over to you. We know that Sayyid Hassan focused on two major points, one the issue of Palestine and the other the issue of the ISIL threat to the region. If you can elaborate on the Palestinian issue, first of all.
Well, I think, first of all, the more important part, the more fundamental part, was about the ISIL threat. But regarding Palestine, you know, it was the normal talk about the Palestinian resistance, about how Palestinians resorting to resistance with the Israelis, how the Palestinians were adopting now the right path in rejecting Israeli conditions. But I think, as I said, the second part, or the issue about ISIL, was probably the most important, you know, focusing on the threat which is posed by ISIL, saying how much of a danger it was to all sides, and speaking of also about, you know, the American projects, comparing ISIL as one of the projects in order to harm the resistance in the region and to benefit Israel. I think that in general was the most important part. His what he said actually highlighted and showed that ISIL is indeed a huge danger. He said more than once that ISIL is an existential danger to all countries of the region and to all different religions, and called for a joint strategy for the region to confront ISIL. So for the first time we see him speaking about the extent or the magnitude of the danger posed by this group, and the fact that all Lebanese have to come together. By the way, before this speech, we have seen Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah meet, for example, with Lebanese figures like Walid Jumblat, who didn't share Hezbollah's evaluation of the situation in Syria, also with other Christian leaders. And so the fact that we have leaders of Lebanese minority groups or sects meeting with Sayyid Hassan, and now his talk about ISIL, there does appear to be a growing Lebanese consensus about the danger which is posed by this group. Now, I think the big question is, how will the other side respond? For example, March 14, will they also agree with Hezbollah's evaluation as to the threat which is posed by ISIL? Will there indeed be a joint Lebanese regional strategy to confront this, particularly after we saw, for example, a new prime minister coming in Iraq, whereby we also were seeing ISIL making this progress? So all in all, I think was a very important strategic piece, strategic speech, which shed light on the real danger of ISIL and the necessity to take this danger seriously, to seriously deal with it strategically, to put together a plan, because from what we can hear, he considered that this threat is no less dangerous than the threat which was posed by Israel. Just as Israel was an existential threat, ISIL is also an existential threat to all sides. So it was a call for all different groups to rally together, to realize that we do have a serious threat which is targeting all different groups, not to take this threat lightly and not to wait, to go ahead now and begin to take the steps in order to confront and deal with the Takfiris.
All right, we'll leave it there for the time. Press Zalariska elaborating on Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's speech from Beirut. Thanks, Sir Ali.